This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi Geekscapists, welcome to a brand new Geekscape podcast. I'm Jonathan London, your host, and if this is your first Geekscape, strap yourselves in for some pop culture talk. This episode is awesome. It's a previously recorded conversation I had with showrunner Chris Black. Chris is the showrunner on Monarch, Legacy of Monsters on Apple TV. It is also known as the Godzilla Show. This takes place in the legendary Godzilla universe. It started in the 2014 Godzilla with Aaron Taylor Johnson. You guys remember that one, and it carried through, like, Kong Skull Island. You got Kong versus Godzilla. There's an upcoming King Kong Godzilla movie coming up in a month or so, and Chris and I had a great conversation about writing genre, TV, show running a room like that, and just really awesome stuff. There's some amazing nuggets in this episode, and I'm really excited for y'all to experience it. This is a perfect Geekscape episode and a fantastic conversation. Not to say that last week's conversation about Madame Web with Christian Blatt wasn't. Some of y'all enjoyed that. I got a message here from my friend Joshua Bevan, who said, "Just listen to your Madame Web episode. I nominate Jonathan London for the Kevin Feige type position at Sony." Sign me up. You know, if you're going to use comic book characters, sign me up. But I think that job is pretty hard. And I hope that I pointed out in that episode just how any of us would have made the same decisions that they made over at Sony and why. And this stuff is not easy. And if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. And you'll hear the conversation with Chris and all the challenges that go into making television here in a bit. As far as consuming stuff goes, things that I want to shout out, there is that new Avatar The Last Airbender live action on Netflix. Some people have not been keen on it, but I want to say congratulations to my friend Michael Goy for being a part of it. Michael and I went to the Warner Brothers TV directing program together. I've only watched 4 or 5 episodes. He's directed the first two. And I can see where some people don't enjoy it. Some of the humor from the show, the fun of it, like some of it is tempered here. There's a little bit more drama. But there's also a lot more action. There's some really cool stuff in this episode, in this series. And I'm really enjoying watching it with Heidi. This is her first experience with the Avatar The Last Airbender universe. And although everyone should watch the cartoon, everybody should watch that original Nickelodeon series, I'm enjoying experiencing the Avatar The Last Airbender stuff through Heidi's eyes. And that's been really cool. The other thing that I'm really enjoying is Titan Books is putting out a brand new Conan the Barbarian series. Zeb Wells, who I think is doing Spider-Man, but Jim Zub is the writer on Conan the Barbarian. And I think he's a fantastic Conan the Barbarian writer. He was doing some of that book for Marvel, but now that the license has gone to Titan is really, really, really doing some awesome work with it. The art's fantastic, and the storytelling's great. Not only that, they've launched a second title in a magazine format, so it's not the size of a comic, it's bigger. And this past week, they put out a brand new Savage Sword of Conan. And I wasn't old enough to experience this by a few years, but in the 70s, Marvel put out a giant, I think black and white, magazine-sized Savage Sword of Conan magazine that has like a couple, you know, Ronnie Howard stories in it. So you get some, maybe Solomon Kane, and then you get some Conan stories, maybe you get some Red Sonja, and that was Savage Sword of Conan. And this magazine has some prose, it's got some comics in it, and it is awesome. I love just how big it is. And a character like Conan should have a big magazine. So if you all are near a comic book store, go pick up The Savage Sword of Conan. It's a really, really cool magazine with lots of cool stuff in it. And if I think they have the first six or so issues out on trade for the Jim Zub written Conan the Barbarian series. And I just think that and the art by Jose Villarrubia is awesome. You're going to love it. If you're into sword and sandals fantasy stuff and you like Conan, I think this is a book that you should be picking up if you're looking for comics to buy. It's one of my favorite comics on the stands. Okay, speaking of writing huge characters, they don't come much bigger than Godzilla. So let's get to the episode. Here's Chris Black and I talking Monarch, Legacy of Monsters. Hey, Chris, how are you?
I'm good. Good morning, Jonathan. Great to see you.
So we're mainly talking about Monarch King. I was going to say King of the Monsters, but that's Godzilla King of the Monsters.
Well, he is the King of the Monsters. So
this is Monarch Legacy of Monsters. And I got about halfway through the show when I said I got to have.
And you were out. You're like, I can't watch this crap anymore. It's like,
come on now. Don't do that. We've known each other long enough and everything you've done since I've known you, I've been a fan of. And then I go back and I'm like, oh, I also liked that. But we met when you were doing,
was it Outcast?
Outcast. It was Outcast. Yeah. And you, that was the first adaptation you did, the Robert Kirkman comic, which I love the comic. I love Paul Azateca's artwork. I love the show. I think you and Patrick Fugit made an incredible show.
That was, I love working with Robert and Paul. I can't remember her, Liz, I think was her name, who did the colors, an amazing team. And Robert is just the nicest guy, the most talented, funny, creative, sweetest guy you'd ever want to work with. He was unbelievably generous to me. And he made it very clear early on that you know, sort of he had creative ownership over the comics, but that I had freedom to make the show what it needed to be. You know, that we didn't have to have this absolute fidelity to what he had written. He just wanted to tell the best story. And he understood that doing a TV show, an episodic TV show, was different than writing a comic. It wasn't the same thing. It required a different, you know, approach. And he was incredibly kind and generous to me. And I would love to do something with him again. We just haven't had the opportunity.
There's an episode you guys added that isn't a narrative in the comic book, but you added the episode about the ex coming back. And there was a history of abuse.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, that was the sister, sister's character, who's, God, it's been so long, I can't remember.
I know, but I just remember watching that episode and just loving that deviation from...
Yeah, Ren Schmidt. I just saw Ren. I had run into Ren, who is now on, and has been for several seasons, on For All Mankind. Mm-hmm. And I saw her and her husband not that long ago. I ran into her at an Apple event and we went and had breakfast, and she's so great. She was so great in that part, you know.
Well, it was all written, and then obviously Severance, which
Severance was, again, I feel like I keep giving all the credit to other people, but but Severance was all Dan Erickson. I mean, Dan Erickson wrote that pilot on spec. It was one of the most brilliant special things that I had ever read. And Dan is just a delight, and just the kindest, sweetest guy who deserves all the recognition and acclaim that he's gotten. And, you know, I came in, he had never sold anything before. He had never run a show. And so I kind of came in as the crusty old veteran to kind of help him assemble a room, hire writers, you know, get a team together, kind of navigate the process of dealing with a studio and a network. And I really saw my role as to just kind of defend and support Dan's vision on that show, because it was so, his voice is so unique. And obviously Ben Stiller did an amazing job. He's an incredible director. So much of the casting and the look of that show was Ben. But the sort of creative DNA of that show was old Dan. And I was really happy to be able to support that project. It's really special. It's one of the most unique special things I've ever been associated with.
Loved it. And now we've got Monarch and Geekscapists. I just want to tell you right now, if you're listening to this, or maybe we'll put this out on video, but if you're watching this or listening to this, we're going to start spoiling it pretty good, because I really want to talk about the full season.
Well, we can spoil it. It's all aired now, right?
It's all aired. It's on Apple Plus.
What's the statute of limitations on spoilers?
I think I just scratched it with that warning and said, right, if you haven't watched all 10 episodes of Monarch Legacy of Monsters, we're going to really get into it. And I think I'll just start, Chris, with like your involvement in it. Was, I mean, were you already circling it or pitching on it, or who came to who first? And obviously Severance was an Apple Plus.
Right. I think the fact that I had an associate, I wasn't circling it. It wasn't something I was aware of. I mean, obviously, well, let me back up. I was obviously aware of Godzilla. I loved the Toho franchise from when I was a kid, you know, watching those movies on on the floor of my parents' living room on the Saturday afternoon chiller theater or whatever, you know, and had seen, you know, all the classic Toho movies and was familiar with the current legendary franchise, had seen those as well, but was not really aware that it was in active development as a TV series. And there was an old friend and colleague of mine who I had worked with years ago at ABC when I was working on shows like Ugly Betty, who was then an exec at Legendary. And I remember it vividly because it was the last in-person meeting, was March of 2020. It was the last in-person meeting I had before everything shut down for COVID. And Nick Pepper is his name, who's a great guy. And he sat down with me and we were talking about things that we could do together. And he said, "Do you know Godzilla?" And I was like, "Well, you know, of course I know Godzilla." And he said, "We've been developing it, you know, Legendary, you know, does the movies, has its own kind of canonical universe, the Legendary feature films that are separate from the Toho mythology." And he said, "We've been trying, it's set up at Apple. We have been trying to develop it as a series for a while. They'd been working with Matt Fraction, but for whatever reason, had just not been able to get it just across the finish line at Apple. Apple just wasn't seeing it yet. Wasn't seeing it as an Apple show."
So Matt was on it first.
Matt was on first. Matt came in early. Matt had been there for a while, had done a few different iterations of it and working with another producing team, these producers at a company called Safe House, and then with the in-house team at Legendary, and had done great work and had really, you know, and Matt is a passionate fan of Godzilla. I mean, Matt Fraction, who was, again, I feel like I just keep heaping praise on other people, who's just a delight and one of the best guys in the world to work with, has the kanji symbols for Godzilla tattooed across his knuckles. So, I mean, that's the degree of the passion, the depth of history and passion that Matt brings to it. But for whatever reason, Apple wasn't seeing it as a show yet. They just were not seeing, you know, what could we bring to this big kind of sci-fi monster driven franchise that felt like an Apple show. And I started working with Matt and with Legendary, and we came up with this way into it that was this young woman, Kate, who discovers that her father is keeping the secret and has a whole other family. And, you know, once we kind of changed our tack and came to Apple and said, it's not a show about monsters, it's a show about people who happen to live in a world where monsters exist, they started to see it as a show for their brand. That was kind of what cracked it open, was the Kate and Kentaro searching for their dad of it all.
And I feel like the original Godzilla that Max Borenstein had been working on had that element, you know, with the humans being
the 2014,
the 2014 version.
Yes.
And then but in 2020, when y'all are having this conversation, there's King of the Monsters, and King of the Monsters really is, it's the monsters. And I love that movie because it is so many of the greatest playing the greatest hits from the Godzilla universe. Right. And of course you want to see Kong versus Godzilla, which was the movie that came out during the you know, it got hit by the pandemic, but it was still really enjoyable. And there's this new one, the Kingdom one, coming out here in March.
Godzilla X.
But it feels like,
but also it's funny with, you know, it's how, what a small town it is in Hollywood, Godzilla X Kong and Godzilla versus Kong, both directed by Adam Wingard, who directed the Outcast pilot.
I remember that. I remember when he was announced for the Outcast pilot. I love that Outcast pilot. And I think that his Godzilla Kong movies are so much fun. And yeah, you can tell that everyone's playing with toys that they love. Right. When you come
it's funny you should say that, refer to them as toys, because it's really, Fraction and I talk about this a lot, is that we are so honored and lucky to come play, like Legendary and Toho invited us into their sandbox and basically said, here, you can play with our toys. Don't break them, but have fun with them, you know? And that
was there a lot of oversight on their end?
There was weirdly more oversight, I think, from Legendary, not in an intrusive way.
No, but it has to dovetail with what they're doing.
It has to dovetail with the feature films. Exactly. And so it was much more like a lot more kind of eyes on us to making sure that we fit neatly into that space. And our timeline for the show is between 2014 Godzilla and King of the Monsters, which there's like a 5-year gap between the movies. So it's a pretty good span of time where we can create our own world where you don't know what's going on in the feature timeline. So we had to take some care with them. Toho was great. Toho was just so excited that we were even doing the show. I mean, they have been incredibly supportive. They loved the show. They loved the scripts. We went, when we shot in Tokyo for the first season, they invited us to the studio, which was, I mean, it was like a pilgrimage. You know, we were going to where these original movies had been made. They have a statue of Godzilla at the entrance to Toho Studios in Tokyo. And they're the best, just incredibly lovely, supportive, smart, fun people to work with. And they're just excited we're doing the show.
The opening of the show, when you have, you know, this is where I was like, oh, this is going to be a lot of fun, because you have the John Goodman version.
Oh, right. The Skull Island.
William Randa, and he's back on Skull Island. And that's your jumping off point, is that you're back with William Randa or Bill Randa that you met in Skull Island. And that's where I felt like you guys were going to cast the entire net and really celebrate the entire Legendary Monsterverse,
right?
And at least hopefully, so, you know, just kind of fit it in here to kind of like fill in the cracks of the stuff that we want to see. And I loved how much more William Randa we got. And then of course, if you read Max Bornstein's graphic novel that came out as a prequel to the 2014 Godzilla, you picked up like the character that he introduced in it, and he's a major character here in Shaw.
Oh, sure. Right. Yeah, no, I did. It was funny. Well, there's a lot there to unpack. I mean, you talked initially about the Godzilla King of the Monsters, which really is this kind of fun grab bag of all the classic monsters. And we knew we kind of couldn't do that because it's not a feature film. We're not telling a complete story in 2 hours. You know, you have to be able to have a story that can continue through 10 episodes. And if we're lucky, a second season, third, fourth, fifth season, who knows? Thank you. So we couldn't just pack all the classic characters into the first episode. You know, we had to sort of, and plus as purely as a practical matter, we didn't have the budget for it. And, you know, we had to tell a human centric story because those big digital monsters are expensive, you know? And if you've seen the first season of the show, Godzilla appears in less than 4 minutes of actual screen time over
that being said
10 episodes, but you feel his presence over the
he's
whole
huge
yeah
you he's have huge. The Golden Gate sequence from the first film,
right?
And how much of that was footage from that first film? None of it. So you had to remake those giant set pieces.
Well, and that I have to give Max Chapman credit, the director, credit for, because when we wrote it, initially the thinking was, well, we'll save money. You know, we'll set it inside the school bus, because you see the buses on the bridge in the movie. And we thought, well, we put this character in that bus, and then we can take footage from Gareth Edwards' film and we can put it through the windows and we can save money that way. And then when Matt Shackman came in, he looked at it and he said, to give you the sequence you want, to give you the impact you want of this character's loss and the trauma this character experiences, we need to stage our own scene. And so that's what he did. And it's spectacular. They shot it in Vancouver in a parking lot with that bus on a big like air bladder. So it bounced up around, and then blue screens all around to put the bridge and everything in the background. And the big rain birds pouring rain up above and filled with extras and cars. And it was fantastic. That was all Matt. And
was there pushback from Legendary?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's always, no, there was not, there was no creative pushback. There was, I think there were always eyes on the money we're spending. And that's partly my job too. I'm, you know, as the executive producer of the show, you know, part of my responsibility is to deliver something within the financial parameters they've given us. And they were generous. It was a generous, I don't want to talk about numbers.
Sure.
But it's far and away the biggest, most expensive thing I've ever been associated with. They gave us a very generous amount of money to accomplish this with, but you find you burn through it very quickly when you start putting Godzilla on the screen. So
can we get some more people talking? Maybe. No, but you guys did a great job of
but
it.
But it makes it a TV show, because a TV show is to, you know, the best TV, I think, is people talking, you know. I mean, and it's the difference between, you know, doing it as a series and doing, say, one of Adam's movies, which is, you know, on an IMAX, designed to be seen on with an audience and on an IMAX movie screen.
That being said, Geekscape, there's a kaiju pretty much in every episode, and there are new kaijus in the universe, and I loved the creativity with that stuff.
We knew it was the Godzilla show. It's like, we couldn't just make it, you know, we couldn't do Mad Men, you know. Mm-hmm. It was like, it had to be, people come, if you call it Monarch Legacy of Monsters, you know, and people refer to it as the Godzilla show, Apple is doing the Godzilla show, fans of the franchise, fans of the movie are going to come and want to see Godzilla. And they, you know, it was a little bit of a balancing act to tell this character driven story about a family, about these people, about a brother and a sister on a journey searching for their father. That was the kind of quest. We talked a lot about the hero's journey. You know, this was their quest, you know, to find their dad and solve the mystery of, you know, of Monarch, but still give the audience what they expect, which is the Monsterverse, you know. And so I think we did a good job. We didn't want it to be monster. We didn't want it to be a Monster of the Week procedural, but we knew there had to be some, either a kaiju presence or a titan or a monster presence, either in the present day story or the flashback story, in pretty much every episode. I think there's only one episode that there's not a monster in. It might be episode 7, which is the May flashback story. I don't think it has a monster in it, but we tried to keep it alive. And part of the mandate too was to embrace the classic canon of monsters. Obviously Godzilla is the premier headliner of season 1. But also to expand the pantheon. I mean, I think Apple very much wanted to see some creatures that were new to their universe, you know, not just mining the, you know, the back catalog of Toho monsters.
The ice mole monster is still my favorite.
It was cool. It turned out great, didn't it? That was
awesome.
Yeah, that was something that I can't remember. It might have been Matt Fraction. Someone in the room had come up with the idea of those, the sort of the star-faced voles or moles that have the face that has the little tentacles on it as a foundation for it. And then Sean Conrad, who's our visual effects supervisor in the team, the concept artists and everybody, kind of evolved it into this kind of weird sort of pangolin armadillo looking thing, you know, with that lives under the ice. And it was cool. It really turned out great.
What I liked about it the most, and why I think it's great to have in an early episode, is it sets up what becomes important later with the ants. And you start to justify some of the sci-fi that makes the characters make sense. And we can talk about Kurt and Wyatt Russell playing the same character and the time jumps. Because I want to find out, like, how you outlined the differences between the 1950 story you're telling and the 2014-15 story that you're telling. And you have to keep both of those parallel. I think only one episode, again, doesn't throw back to the 50s. And then was it similar to the same way you're outlining and keeping parallel stories with Severance, where things are happening in the same at the same time in Severance for the most part, but the characters are living in two different worlds of the same character. Like, how are you outlining that stuff, and how are you planting things like seeds, etc.?
It's funny, I hadn't really thought about it much, maybe subconsciously, but until you just mentioned it. But it is very much like the innie outie world of Severance. And I mean, the main thing is you just do it in the room, Matt and I, and the other writing EP on the show, Andy Colville, and the staff. We have a great staff of writers. You put things up on the board, and you put colored cards up, and these are the present day cards. And here's the, we would always refer to Shaw, older character is Shaw and younger character is Lee. So there would be Shaw and Lee, because he was Lee in the past and Shaw in the present, and they would have different color cards, and we would put them up, and you would sort of be able to, and you would move things around, and you would just be able to kind of look at the boards and see, oh, you know, this story is too weighted towards the present. There aren't enough flashback cards, but you know, tracking the storylines, it wasn't always easy. I mean, there were times I joke where we would get excited about a pitch, and our writer's assistant would kind of go, guys, that character hasn't been born yet. And we'd be like, oh, shit. You know, like, that's right. Because we'd get so wrapped up in telling the story that we weren't keeping track of what year it was, you know. But it all sorted out. I'm sure if you watch the show closely, and I'm sure there are people on Reddit who are, there's probably stuff we screwed up and things that don't line up quite right and stuff that always slips through the cracks. But when, you know, we tried to be really diligent about, you know, it's all planning. It's all just the more time you have to build the architecture, to blueprint it out, you know, and pressure test it, then it works on the screen. And we would try, in terms of making the stories line up, sometimes they were linked by a plot element, but what we tried to do most often was link them sort of emotionally. Like, what is going on in the past with these characters that is reinforcing how they feel in the present? You know, what, you know, I think, you know, episode 6 is a good example. Episode 8 is a good example of what Shaw was going through in the past that informed the decisions that he made in the present. You know, those were the kind of linkages that we made or tried to make when they worked.
Well, we've met that world before in Kong versus Godzilla, the underneath. Was there, when you start to introduce the element that time works drastically different in between the worlds, and we'll absolutely talk about the Kiko Shaw reunion scene, but was there anything that on the legendary side caused, you know, some conflict there, where it's like, where legendary is like, well, we have both worlds in our movies too, and that might change the plots in our, you know, because they have the same worlds. Do they want to play by the same rule of time?
I think that was the biggest minefield that we stumbled into in breaking the first season, you know, was that it evolved a lot. It changed over the course of the season. It was not supposed to originally end the way it ended. It was like one of the, I'll give you a little peek behind the curtain. I mean, the initial idea was that they were going to travel to Hollow Earth and they were going to find Hiroshi there, the father, was where he disappeared to. And we got about midway through the season and it started feeling like this, that the search for dad was getting very frustrating. Like that they were just missing him. How many more times could they just miss him? And we got to episode 6, and I believe it was Andy Colville in the room who pitched, well, why don't they just find him? What if they just find him? You know, maybe that's the surprise we need. That's the twist we need, is that they come up over that sand dune in North Africa. Well, I'm sorry?
Not technically a sand dune.
Yeah, not technically a sand dune, no. Well, there weren't a lot of sand dunes in British Columbia where we shot
right.
it. So that kind of mountain ridge or whatever.
It was a sleeping Godzilla what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
It's not a sand dune at all. He's taking a cat.
That was a very early, I think that was a very, very early pitch by Joby Harold, who was one of our non-writing producers, who kind of said, wouldn't it be cool if we had a scene that played out on Godzilla's body?
Yeah.
And that ultimately evolved into that sequence where he was kind of sleeping in the desert in North Africa and the dunes. It's one of my favorite episodes. That's episode 6. It's one of my favorite episodes of the season. And the Sean and the VFX team just knocked it out of the park. I mean, it's that big reveal where he, you know, rises up and he knocks the helicopter out of the sky. And there's a shot. And I remember this is a great budget conversation because there was a shot where Godzilla kind of his tail sweeps around over the guy's heads and then hits this kind of cliff face behind them. And that shot was on the chopping block. It was a really expensive shot and we were over budget. And I remember us having a conversation when we were spotting VFX saying, it's like it puts our characters in the frame with him. It gives a sense of scale. It's one of the only shots where they're actually tied into frame with him.
You need that for Jeopardy for sure.
And it was a really expensive shot, but I felt it was really important. And so we put it in and it's great. It's, you know, it's really spectacular. But yes, it was God. It was not, you're right. It was not a sand dune. It was Godzilla, but it was like the, so then the whole back half of the season changed. It wasn't, you know, it was like, and I can't remember at what point in the development, I think we knew very early on that we didn't want Keiko to be dead, that when she drops down that hole, that rift, that chasm at the plutonium plant in the beginning, that, you know, we knew we would see her again. We wanted to see her again. I don't think we had quite figured out yet how that was going to play out, you know. And just over the course of breaking the season and a lot of people pitching ideas, you know, that the idea of her being sort of preserved in time and not having age it's not the most, it's a genre trope. It's not like the most original idea in the world, but we knew we wanted that actor back, Mari Yamamoto, cause she's amazing. And, as you say, it teed up that fantastic scene with her, and Kurt at the end when they see each other again for the first time. But to talk about the legendary of it all, you know, we had originally pitched it as Hollow Earth because we knew that was kind of a key piece of the feature mythology. And then the feature team started getting a little nervous about it because their movie was coming out and Hollow Earth was a huge component of that. And I think they were concerned that the stories weren't going to line up and they didn't want us stepping on each other's toes. So it was a little bit of a little dance. We came up with this idea of Axis Mundi, which is sort of a subterranean realm, an alternate realm where time moves differently. That's sort of Hollow Earth adjacent,
Hollow Earth. So the characters in the film can still age concurrently with anybody on Earth.
Exactly. We had to kind of create our own little kind of pocket of time and space within the larger mythology, which it was a little bit of a last minute shuffle to figure out. But I think at the end of the day, it really worked well for story.
Well, Chris, I mean, I texted you immediately. And then shortly after I texted you, it was on like TV Line or something. The recognition for that scene with the reunion scene between Shaw and Keiko. And for what you said earlier about this, yes, it's a Godzilla show, but it's about the humans. That must have been a great reward to have the recognition for that scene specifically being two human scenes. And it was awesome. Can you just talk about where that idea came from and how do you, I don't know. You didn't have a whole lot of, I mean, you still got to fit this within an action show. So the economy of that scene, how do you keep the dialogue down? How do you, does that make sense? Like the blocking?
Yeah. Sometimes you just can't worry about being economical. Sometimes sure. You just have to let the scene be what it is. And then you find in the editing room, you get in the editing room and, you know, you can kind of play with it and craft it and shape it. And if it feels like it's dragging, you could tighten it up or you lose a line here or there. But, you know, I mean, I think that was a scene that you just knew was playing. And it really is, you know, a testament to those two actors. You know, there was a scene that was on the page. But Kurt was very passionate about that scene. He had a very specific idea of how he wanted to play that scene.
The blocking of hiding was his idea?
That was his idea. He really wanted... Yeah, he really wanted to do it. It wasn't original. It's been a while. I don't really remember.
Sure.
But I don't think it was not originally written that way. And it was, it was his idea that he couldn't just appear to her, that he had to somehow kind of prepare her for what she was about to see.
That he had aged and she had not,
That he had aged and she had not, and that he needed to sort of speak to her before she saw him. And it was brilliant. It was like, I have to give all credit, really, to Kurt for that. And
but I'm going to ensure that you keep some credit by the end of this conversation.
No. I mean, that was really, he really asserted some ownership over that, which you know, it is a collaboration. We have a creative team. We have a team of artists. You know, between the production people and the writing staff and the actors, you know, the cast, and with that cast, that entire cast, not just Kurt and Wyatt, but all of them, that cast is a gift for a writer, you know, Kiersey and Anna and Ren, Takahiro, who plays Hiroshi, is just one of the finest actors I've ever worked with in my career, and even in some of the smaller roles. I mean, Joe Tippett, who plays the character of Tim, is just that guy's the best. I mean, just, he's gold. You can give him anything and he will make something great out of it, you know. So
it's a bit of the voice of the audience, like, what are you guys doing here? What is that? Exactly.
You know, and his partner, Elisa, who plays the character of Duval, those two just worked great together. I mean, everything just clicked. I mean, all those pieces. You know, and the actresses who played the moms, everybody. I was incredibly, you know, we were just blessed to have those actors. But that scene between Mari and Kurt was so much a product of, yes, there were words on the page. We wrote a scene, but what that scene became really was ultimately a function of those two actors kind of making that moment. Happen and her reaction is so heartbreaking, you know, as she puts together, she does the math in her head before Shaw even reveals himself, you know, and her realizing what this means for her husband and her son that she left behind is heartbreaking. The writers were on strike during a lot of the post-production, and so I wasn't able to go do a lot of the sound mixes. But that the strike ended, and episode 110 was the only one I was able to actually go to the mix stage and be there when they mixed it, and which is great fun. There's not really a lot for you to do at that point. Everything's kind of been everything's already been done. But to go and sit on the mix stage and watch it with the post team and the mixers on the big screen booming through those big speakers, and I was glad. I was joking. They dimmed the lights, and I was glad because I was crying like a baby at the end of that. You know,
it must have felt great to have that scene.
It's very satisfying.
It's the episode. I mean, the episode you wrote. Again, I love the Severance episode you wrote as well as a highlight for me.
I'm not just saying
that because you're my guest. Like, those are solid episodes.
Well, thanks. I mean, look, I'm a decent writer. I think
There it is. We're going to get you to pat yourself on the back.
I mean, I think I've been doing it long enough. I wouldn't have survived in the business as long as I have. You know, my hair wouldn't be this white if I wasn't able to put it on the page when it mattered, but it's not for me anyway. It's not about the lone artist sitting in his writer's shack, you know, tortured, you know. It's like, at the end of the day, your mission is not to like put words on a page. Your mission is to make a movie or a TV show. And the only thing the audience has, we're not mailing our scripts out to the audience to sit in their living rooms and read. The only thing they have is what they see on their TV screens or their iPhones or their iPads or however they're watching it. So it is a truly collaborative effort between everybody. And Severance, it's like, you know, that episode that has my name on it, I'm very proud of, and we won some awards for the show, which I'm really grateful for. But so much of that was, you know, was Dan's genius and Ben's vision and those actors, and you know, it doesn't work unless all the members of the team are working together.
Does that create a safe space environment for pitching, where in the room where it's like, hey, you know what, like I got the something's coming to me, I'm gonna throw it out there, somebody run with it? I mean, it feels like if you build the room right, we can talk about that as showrunner, but like if you build the room right, people should feel that fearless that, yes, my name's going to go on the episode, but I know that some of these talented people in the room are going to help catch me and maybe finish my the sentence that's forming in my head.
Well, that's, I mean, you hit it. I mean, it's 100%. To me, building the room is the single most important thing in the job of being a showrunner. I mean, it's, you know, the team that you get together, everybody has to be pulling in the same direction, and it has to be a safe space. You have to be willing and feel safe to pitch your craziest, dumbest ideas and throw shit out there and not be worried that people will make fun of you. And I've always encouraged that, you know, it's like, and some of the worst, dumbest ideas they get pitched in the room come from me. So it's like, I'm, you know, in, you know, if it, and everybody laughs and goes, yeah, that's a dumb idea, but what if, you know, sure. Then you, it generates a conversation and moves things forward. And the team, building the team, I stole after the first season of Severance. I just pulled as many of those writers over to Monarch as I could. Andy Colville, Amanda Overton, Carrie Drake, our writer's assistant, Tanner Hansinger. You know, I just plundered that room, you know, and dragged them over to Monarch, and you, there is a trust, and I'm always excited to meet new people. And, you know, there were a couple of writers, Mariko Tamaki and Al Letson, and people who'd come into the room who I hadn't worked with before that were just a joy and a revelation. But like Andy Colville, I've worked on three shows with Amanda Overton. I've worked on three shows with Carrie Drake. I've worked with on two shows. It's like, you know, there's a trust, you know, and a familiarity, and you know what they're going to bring to the table. And it's like you say, creating a safe space. If it's a bunch of colleagues and friends who have that collective experience, you know, you know, you're safe, you know, you can come in and pitch your craziest, dumbest stuff, and it's going to, and some good ultimately, hopefully will come out of it.
I got just a little bit more, but
sure.
Did they give you, I mean, you guys had the starting point, the bridge on the Golden Gate Bridge and Godzilla's.
Well, the starting point technically was Skull Island.
Skull Island, yes.
I mentioned that before. It was like, I can't remember.
Did you guys pitch that, or was that something that Legendary was like, these are your parameters, you guys can exist within these benchmarks, these goalposts?
I don't want to take credit that isn't due, but I think that was my pitch. I think it was something I came up with in the pilot script. But if
because Monarch's a huge part of that movie, and so it makes a lot of sense that you start quote unquote at the beginning, and then that came from
Matt, okay. the Bill Randa, that if it's about Monarch, if it's about the history of Monarch, to go back to World War II and post World War II and start with Billy Randa, young Billy Randa, that was Matt's idea. And I liked this idea of linking it to the feature franchise. Obviously, we wanted a big cold open. We wanted to start with a big monster fight just to let the audience know, okay, this is the Godzilla show. You're going to get, you know, you start in Skull Island, and then there's the giant spider fighting the giant crab. And it's like, okay, strap in. This is what you're going to get. And linking it to the feature franchise. And we loved, of the feature films, Matt and I are big fans of Kong Skull Island. And we felt tonally that was the kind of show we wanted to do, a big adventure show. And in some of the other shows like King of the Monsters and in the 2014 Godzilla, we liked the fact that they were more character focused, kind of that they focused on these families, but they were also very dark.
And they're not an ensemble in the way that Skull Island is an ensemble.
They also were very sort of, you know, as we would joke, you end up with a lot of, you know, dead kids and dead parents in those in those movies. And,
yes.
And we wanted something that was a little more up, you know, that was a little more fun. That was
so you kill a bunch of kids on a school bus immediately? Wait a minute, you're betraying yourself.
but they weren't characters you knew. So. But we wanted Kate's trauma. We wanted Kate needed to be traumatized.
Sure.
That was really key. And so that was her. And you only see Godzilla in the pilot episode through her post-traumatic flashback. But we wanted, and partly what Apple wanted was a big, on the macro, a big globe-trotting, fun adventure show. You know, where they go, and we felt tonally, in terms of kind of being, you know, a big action-packed kind of monster adventure, that Skull Island was a better template. That was more of a template that we wanted to follow than, say, Godzilla King of the Monsters was.
Was there a landing zone that they gave you for the final episode? Because the final episode, the big spoiler is that we get Kong in the last sequence.
I think there was, because Kong has become such a popular character in the features, and really kind of drives and owns the feature franchise now, I think there was... They never dictated anything to us. They never said, you have to do this or make sure you put Kong in the show. But I think there was a sense that if, as the show evolved, that Kong could become a character in it, there was excitement about that. So, and we were, and we love Kong too. So we were happy to, you know, happy to do it. But that opening prologue in the pilot with John Goodman, I wrote it never expecting that we would get John Goodman. I thought this is for the page. We'll get everybody excited about it, and then ultimately it'll be something else. We'll do something else because John Goodman won't be available, or, you know, he won't be interested, or we won't be able to afford him. And it turned out all those things were wrong. He was delightful and happy to do it, and a trooper, and flew to Hawaii.
That helps.
And shot for 2 days. And the one thing he said when they approached him, when casting approached him about doing this, was, he was actually worried that we weren't going to be happy because he's physically, you know, changed quite a bit since that movie was made. He, as he pointed out, he'd gotten much healthier. He had, he had lost a lot of weight and was in, you know, a much healthier place than he was when that movie was made. And he was concerned that we were not going to be satisfied with his performance or how we looked. And, you know, but once we got him out there, and clearly he's older, that movie was made a few years ago, but, you know, once you got him in the makeup and the beard and the hat and the costume and everything, it was great. It was like, oh, my God, there's Bill Randa.
Again, it goes into the question I had for the Golden Gate sequence, where it's like, was that footage from the – I mean, was that – what was that sequence? I thought it was awesome.
I don't think – I could be wrong. I don't think – and someone will correct me when they hear this. I don't think we used any footage from
– Sure.
From the movie. There might have been a shot or two through the bus windows. I could be wrong about that, but the whole sequence of, you know, the bus falling and Kate tumbling out and looking up and seeing Godzilla and Godzilla tearing through the suspension cables. And that was all, Matt Shackman and the visual effects team.
It had to be a very specific POV or it wouldn't have worked. Right?
Well, POV is interesting. It was one of the things we talked about in the show, was that we wanted, because we were telling a character driven story, we wanted the POV to be ground level. We wanted the POV to be as these characters experience their world. Matt Fraction would say, we're not doing a 9/11 show. We're doing a 9/12 show. It's sort of the day after. It's like, how do you pick yourself up? And, you know, everything had to be from that ground level looking up. I think there's only one shot in the season that is one of those kind of God's eye hero shots, and it's in 6 when Godzilla rises up out of the desert and then the camera kind of sweeps around him, and you know, from like a helicopter POV, and you sort of see him rise up in his full majesty. And I could be wrong, I think that's the only shot that's not done from a human on the ground perspective looking up at the monsters.
I'm trying to think if there's one at the Bikini Atoll just for
sure. There might be one at Bikini Atoll where the camera swoops back up along his spine. But
for the most part, y'all shot Godzilla like Jaws on that one, and you were kind of keeping things at water
from a distance. Like you're looking through binoculars and you're looking through lenses, and it's the people on the beach, and what are they seeing? And there is, you're right, there is a shot where it cuts out to where Godzilla is out with the H-bomb. But
that's it.
What we tried to do is really tell it from the point of view of these characters.
Okay. Eric in our Facebook Forever or Geekscape Forever group says, how much did Kurt and Wyatt develop the character together? Because they're never in any scenes together, obviously, but was it planned beforehand or did it just fall into place? You've talked about how Kurt developed some of the blocking and some of the scenes and beats, but did they ever throw football to each other and say, well, if you set that up, I can pay it off in the modern day storyline?
Yeah, they absolutely did. And I think they were, and they, if you have a chance to talk with them, they could speak to it more directly. But I think they were very mindful of and excited about this idea that they were playing the same character, that it wasn't a father and a son, that it wasn't, you know, that it was that the character that they were creating was the same character, and the history and the mannerisms and all that stuff needed, obviously, he's a more mature character later who's been through a lot and learned a lot and views life differently. But they very much, I wasn't on, I remember Matt Fraction telling me sometimes that like Kurt would show up when, you know, Wyatt was shooting and he would look at the monitors and he would watch, they would watch each other's performance. And there are times when they do it, honestly, that I don't think it's planned. I think there's stuff that's just genetic. I think there are times when Wyatt will do a little look or a head turn or something, and you just go, "Oh, that's Kurt."
Yeah, like your dad does that.
I could be wrong. I don't think they planned it that way. I think that's just the fact that they are father and son. But they did, yeah. To my understanding, was they absolutely coordinated that crafting and creating that character together.
And I never read the Godzilla Awakening story that Max did. Honestly, I know Max.
I have it around here somewhere.
But I've never, Max, apologies. Last time I saw Max was at an event for Winning Time over at the Academy. And I love you, Max, but I haven't read his Godzilla Awakening. I'm guessing that was given to Matt Fraction to be like, here's some of the tools in our toy, here's some of the toys we have. And he took that character that originated in the graphic novel and put it into.
Well, I did that, actually.
You did that. Okay, but, so even though Matt was on first and dealing with the legendary
The Shaw character came later, was not originally conceived, as I recall, and apologies, Matt Fraction, if I'm remembering this wrong. Yeah. But I don't think in Matt's original pitch, I don't think the Shaw character was a character. We had been given the whole... And apologies to Max Bornstein, that we had been given the whole canon, but we had also been told that the comic storylines we did not have to adhere to, that they were, you know, that yes, they were available to us. We could use them if they worked for us. They were part of the larger mythology, but they were not necessarily considered strict canon for the features. And so the thing that we had to adhere to was the feature canon. And if there was stuff in the comic series that we could use, great, but we weren't beholden to it. But then I went back and read them all, and we knew we wanted this military character. We had made up this, you know, this guy who existed in both timelines. And this was before Kurt and Wyatt were cast. He was just this character in the show, Lee Shaw, you know. And as I was reading through all of the comics, there was this character who was an army person that Serizawa, I believe, encounters in the past. And I think he's just referred to as Shaw. I don't know if he even has a first name.
Sure.
And I thought, oh, let's make him that guy. He's in the mythology. He exists in the world. You know, I don't believe he's a big character I think he just kind of comes and goes as a military guy on one of Serizawa's missions. But I was like, okay, well, since we're living in this larger world, why not make this a character who's already there, who's already a part of it, you know? And so appreciation to Max for giving us that guy.
And it's great, 'cause I mean, it tightens the net, you know, it really, this whole tapestry that you guys are playing with, it really fills in a lot of blanks. It's fun. I think the audience appreciates it. And so we've talked about Monarch. I have to ask you what your favorite kaiju is from your childhood and maybe from the show.
Well, look, it's Godzilla. But it's Godzilla. I mean, Godzilla is the one that, you know, I grew up with. Again, I'm old enough to have watched these old, you know, movies on my parents' black and white television, you know, when I was a kid, and they would run, you know, whatever the independent TV station was, I assume would buy them in like packages. And so
there's a marathon. Just, yeah.
Yeah, so they would just run them on the $1 million movie or whatever, you know, and it was this giant lizard, which was clearly a guy in a rubber suit stomping around, kicking over buildings and stuff like that. And that, when you're 5 or 6 or 8 years old, is what just sucked you into that. It seemed so real. And so he still, to me, is the is the king of the monsters, and they're all fun, you know. I mean, I've soft spot for Hedera, the smog monsters, like yes. one of my favorites, you know.
But we're Matt not going to see Godzuki anytime.
I don't think so. I love Rodan. I'm a sucker for a fire breathing dragon.
Love Rodan. In that yeah. in the Rodan film, when they're opening with them, the Rodan script and the Rodan film is actually such an incredibly sound movie.
One of my favorite moments in the Rodan, and I keep pitching this, and we have not yet figured out a way to put it in the show, is there's a great mislead in the Rodan movie where these guys, if I'm remembering it correctly, these guys are going down into this mine,
and there's a monster mine
that's killing them. And what they initially discover are these big kind of like gross kind of grubs the size of school buses mm-hmm. or something. And you think that's the monster. And then what you realize later is, no, those are the little mealworms that Rodan eats. And it's like the monster itself is like 100 times bigger.
And you guys have mealworms kind of creatures in this. You know, they pull Kiko into the...
Yeah, the little, the endoswarm, I think they call them.
Right. But they were flying almost, and they were insectoid kind of
little things, but they were, it's funny because we just, in the script, they would just be, I can't remember what they called them, they had a very generic, you know, the creatures or the insects or the insectoids or whatever we called them, and then, but... legendary mythology was very, you have to make up names for everything. They all have to have a name.
I mean, would you love it if they suddenly were like, hey, that shrew creature you guys had in the ice thing, can we pull that into one of the films? And
oh my God, of course. It would be
how awesome would that be? So we're talking kaiju to wrap up. Chris, we got to talk about the kaiju in the room, and that would be Godzilla minus one.
Well, look, I mean, here's the thing. Is Godzilla's having a moment, you know, and we kind of look at it as anything that's good for Godzilla is good for all of it. The rising tide raises all the Godzilla boats. So yes. It's like we don't
even if they're exploding ordnance up the coast.
I mean, we're
Tokyo.
Humbled. You look at a movie, and you're kind of humbled, you know, you're like, oh my God, here's something that's a dramatic.
I don't think it's in competition. It's awesome, but, though.
Yes, exactly. We don't feel that we're in competition with that. That anything that we feel fills out it's not a competition, but there is some pressure to feel that we need to do. We need to raise our level of writing and our level of dramatic storytelling. To you know, it's not a competition, but we don't want. To do, you know, something that seems silly or dumb or inconsequential, you know.
Were
when
you
something
worried like that it got too Scooby, like too Scooby Doo with the
our show? No, I wasn't.
The drama you guys had, like you said, 4 minutes of Godzilla in your show for the most part, and lots of human drama. You look at Godzilla minus one, and it's lots of human drama and a small amount of Godzilla as well. I would say they're comparable more than they're. Competitive. I mean, I'm sure some of it would inform the next season of Monarch in a stylistic or a narrative way, but it's two different universes, too.
I think it's like we got to. I think what it does is, and I'm trying to, I don't want to say anything. Sure. I'm trying to be very careful with my words here. I think we're not in competition with them, and we don't feel we should be competition with them. And our colleagues and partners at Toho do not feel we're in competition with them, but we look at something that good, that well executed, and that dramatic and powerful, and you feel, well, it raises the bar for all of us. It's like, okay, now season two's got to be even greater. Season two's got to be even more, you know, potent and dramatically relevant because they are telling such great story in that world, and we have to do that too. Not that we want to make our show into Godzilla minus one because it's not, mm-hmm. but it's like okay, the bar gets raised. I mean, you know, and you know, the movies, the feature films, and our TV show and the Toho projects are all, they're all separate and very different, but, you know, they all hopefully are exploring different facets, different kind of tonal avenues of what you can do. I think it's a testament to the power and the longevity and the breadth and the scope of Godzilla. There's so many different ways into that story.
It must be really reaffirming that something comes out that is a majority of a drama and it still, you know, finds a place, a really passionate place with the, with an audience, in that that's what you guys were designing. They did it as well. And the audience has an appetite for that kind of monster storytelling where it doesn't just have to be WrestleMania with kaiju. Going into
not that there's anything wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that. We're going to get it with this next Kong versus Godzilla movie. I mean, like the older Kong has a power glove from what I can tell. Like, I'm in. I'm in. You know, I'm there.
Robot arm.
I'm there opening day for older Kong, you know, cranky Kong with a guy with a power glove. I'm in. You had me a giant metal glove with, on a Kong.
But I think it does prove, I mean, the longevity. I mean, this has been a franchise for 70 years. I mean, 1954 was the first Godzilla film, and that it has that longevity and staying power is extraordinary. And it's a heavy responsibility too for us. I mean, that we gotta look, and not everyone's gonna love everything. And I'm incredibly gratified that people have responded well to the show. The reviews have been really positive. People like the show, people watch the show, but you know, there are always people who are gonna think we're doing it wrong, or we're doing a disservice, or we're telling the wrong story, or there aren't enough monsters, or whatever. You can't please everyone, but we take it very seriously, and that the people who work on the show, Matt and myself and everybody, love this franchise, love, pardon the pun, the legacy of it, you know, and you know, we're Godzilla super fans, and we want to try and tell the best version of it that we can and make as many people excited about it as we can.
Well, I loved it, Chris. I loved it, okay. And you got my running commentary through the season, and I apologize for those early.
No, I'm always happy. If I get texts that say I love, oh, wow, that's great, or holy shit, I'm always happy to get those texts. Loved it.
And I can't wait for season two. I am knocking on wood that I haven't heard anything yes or no, but I'm knocking on wood.
It's not official. Obviously, I the show did very well for Apple. They're very happy. Everyone's very excited about it. It's hard to imagine that they're not going to want more. You know, the staff has been, we have been working on stories. We have stories to tell, but we're waiting. So we're still waiting for an official production green light. But that we're all optimistic. We all are optimistic that it's going to come, and we'll be able to keep telling the story.
Loved it. Absolutely loved it. And crossing the fingers for the rest of it. And obviously I'm there opening day for the next Kong Godzilla movie. These are the movies I wanted when I was 12.
Of course.
I still want as a 45-year-old man.
Yeah. Me too.
Chris, I thanks for doing this. And I hope I can see you soon. Comic-Con might get a little stickier for me with our baby is due.
Congratulations on that. It is about prioritizing. I mean, yes. The work is important. I always say, you know, we bring, you know, you pour 100% of yourself into the job. If you take the job, you take it seriously. You know, you bring your A game every single day. But always family first, you know, there's more important things in life than television. And if, you know, I look at my daughters every day and am reminded of that. So
incredible. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Jonathan. We'll talk again.
Yes, sir. How great was that conversation? I didn't lie to you. I try not to lie to you or be hyperbolic on this show. I was so looking forward to having Chris on the show to talk about this specific experience of working with Monarch and Toho and Kurt Russell and just everybody involved. It's awesome. And Matt Fraction, of course, you got to mention Matt Fraction because he came from the comic book world. And now he's the co-creator on Monarch Legacy of Monsters with Chris. And I hope you enjoyed that conversation. If you did, send me an email, jonathan@geekscape.net. We've got lots of cool Geekscapes coming down the road. So subscribe, share this with your friends. I want more conversations like this where we're just talking storytelling and pop culture and everything that we're celebrating right now. I feel like we're at this inflection point in our culture where it's all comics, it's all genre, and the geeks are king. Maybe not king of the monsters, but king of the multiplexes, king of the TV streaming stuff, and king of the comic book stands, where they've really kind of been the whole time. And of course, king of the video games. There's tons of video game stuff coming on that I'd love to have on the show. So Geekscapists, you know your mission. Leave a 5-star review for us on any podcatcher you're using to listen to this. Share it with your friends. If you're watching this on YouTube, if you're watching Geekscape on YouTube, this conversation with Chris will be up in a few days on YouTube, so you can share the video with your friends. But please leave like a thumbs up. That really helps the algorithm float us into other people's eyeballs. That always helps. And again, like I said with the podcasts, like, share it, leave the 5-star reviews. Those also help the algorithms on things like Spotify and Apple Podcasts recommend us to people of like minds. And that's why we built Geekscape. So we have our own little watering hole that we can kind of hang around and share cool stuff. And this is our clubhouse, okay? It's called Geekscape. And we built it for a reason, folks. So we can bring in more friends and share in the excitement and have awesome episodes like this one. Thank you so much, and you'll hear from me next week. Don't hate, create. Peace.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.